Accession number 4656, room number 1.
Sefton, Wheel 1. Could you begin, Mr. Sefton, by telling me how you came to join the RAF?
Yes. When I was a lad, I was working at Scammell's Motor Engineers in Aldgate, and I had a 5-year apprenticeship, which I served mainly in the machine shop. And at the end of that time, I was transferred to the drawing office and worked there as a tracer with a view to becoming a draftsman. Well, it so happened that Scammell's decided to move their main workshop to Watford, and the drawing office was going to move en bloc, which resulted in me either having to go to Watford or my parents wouldn't permit it because I was only a lad. I had then to go back into the machine shop. Well, then it wasn't really to my requirements. I didn't want to be a machine minder, a driller, miller, or lathe turner all my life. So I decided then to join the Air Force. That was brought about mainly because about that time there was an engineers strike, and all the engineers were out and only left the apprenticeships and the boys in the machine shop. And what with one thing and another, I didn't see any future in that engineering line.
This was in 1923.
Yes.
Now, when you joined the Air Force, you decided to train as a wireless operator mechanic.
Well, I went to Whitehall to enlist, and they gave us or showed us a list of trades that were available. Such trades as cooks and batmen and other doorkeepers didn't really appeal to me, and as I had had a mechanical engineering experience, I plumped for a wireless operator mechanic because I thought, well, wireless is in its infancy, I am mechanically minded, and the trade would probably suit me. Apart from that, it was the highest rate of pay in the Air Force.
Did you set any tests or anything when you went to Whitehall? Did you do a trade test or anything like that?
We were given elementary tests of an educational test to see whether we were a qualified, you know, up to standard before we were accepted.
Now, in November 1923, you went to Uxbridge for your initial training.
That's true, yes. I think it was 3 months training, and we did what was known as loosely a square bashing, but it was the initial training, rifle drill, marching, etc., etc., for about 3 months.
You didn't do any specific trade training there?
No trade training at all. We were mostly engaged in guard duties on a regular basis and fatigues on Wednesday afternoons and things like that. And cold fatigue, that was rather something that wasn't taken kindly to by us recruits, but it was all drill and musketry. No technical training whatsoever.
How many people would be at Uxbridge at any one time?
Well, it was a big square at Uxbridge, and to be honest, I think it was pretty well full. There was perhaps half a dozen squads, say 50, I guess, 50 in a squad at a time, all marching around the square, stamping about, going backwards and forwards, and rifle drill.
So after 3 months at Uxbridge, you went to the Electrical and Wireless School at Flowerdown.
Yes, that's true, yes.
Could you describe what life at Flowerdown was like and what your training was like?
Well, it was educational. We had to do the maths, English and everything educational. It was, and in addition to that, we had to do learn the Morse code, semaphore. We also had a certain amount of engineering. It was really and truly, looking back, it was more like a City and Guilds level. We had to start electricity, magnetism, and everything appertaining to wireless right from the beginning, which was a bit difficult when I'd had no electrical training and I didn't know a great deal about electricity or what it would do or how or what the results were from electricity. So that was really the biggest obstacle that I had to overcome, apart from the fact that I had to learn the Morse code and pass out at 25 words a minute.
Were your instructors service instructors or civilian instructors?
Civilian instructor. The civilian instructor I had was an ex-petty officer from the Navy. All the instructors, as far as I can recollect, were civilian. The supervisory grade, like the warrant officers in charge of the block, they were service, and of course we did have the usual drill to supplement the day's activities as well, but the technical side were civilian, although there was a squadron leader, I think, was the chief instructor, or flight lieutenant. He may have been a flight lieutenant then.
Were there any aircraft at Flowerdown?
No aircraft whatsoever. There was the boys' training, the apprentices' training school. They had a three-year course. They were the some of what they call the trenchyard boys, and they were on a camp on their own. And they were on a three-year course, but they were similar to us, except that it was more extensive. They were younger than us. I mean, we were adults, 18, 19. They were 15, and they were doing a three-year course and expected to pass out at about 18 or 18 plus. But they were getting a much more comprehensive training than we men were.
What sort of accommodation did you have in Florida?
It was hutted accommodation. I think there was 30 to a hut or more, divided in two. With iron bedsteads, fold-up iron bedsteads, the usual, what they used to call the McDonald beds. You make your bed up into three pillows or three mattresses and push the bottom bit in and polish your floor space.
Now, after passing out from Flowerdown, you were posted in July 1925 to the School of Army Cooperation at Old Sarum.
Yes, that's correct.
What were you doing there?
Well, we were brought forward a few months. We were brought forward a few months so that we could partake in the 1925 manoeuvres with the army. And two operators, one experienced. I had an LAC I was with, and I was a raw rookie. We were attached to a M battery, RHA, which was part and parcel of a unit. I think the other part was a cavalry unit, of which the Duke of Gloucester was an officer. But the idea was that it was a rather extensive manoeuvre with the army, utilising wireless, probably for the first time, with aircraft sending back the positions of the fall of the shells back to us with our little wireless sets, who we would then pass on the, using the clock code, we would then pass on the fall of the shells or the shots to the battery commanders, who would adjust their guns accordingly. So we were actually working with aircraft from our own station, receiving their messages by the Morse code.
You were attached to a horse artillery battery?
M battery, yes.
Were you... Did you have horses yourselves?
Pardon?
Did you have horses yourselves?
We were given a horse each, probably because we had the old breeches and putties then, and we were breeches and putty service then. And after about 3 days, either they got short of horses, or their horses were sick, or the officer may have seen a horse bite my hand when I tried to feed it. But we were then taken off of horses, and for the remainder of the manoeuvres, we rode on the limber, which was attached or drawn behind the guns, behind the gun carriage. And as is usual with the artillery, they invariably park under trees, in woods, anywhere out of sight until they went into action. Then they galloped across Salisbury Plain to their position, uncoupled the guns, swung them round. We were riding on probably metal seats on limbers. If we weren't shook up by the time we got there, then the chances are that the wireless set was. So we couldn't always guarantee that we were giving 100%, but we got by.
After the manoeuvres were over, you were posted overseas, is that correct?
Yes, I went to what was then Mesopotamia, and I went from Southampton, and I think the name of the boat was the Assay, and it took us, I think, almost a month to get there.
Did you volunteer for an overseas posting?
Or no, there were no volunteers. It was just detailed overseas posting.
Now, you were posted to Number 6 Squadron, which was based at Mosul.
Mosul,
in
yes.
What is now Iraq.
Well, that's right. We landed at Basra, and we went by cattle truck. What was then a 4 horses or 20 men on the side, and we went as far as Baghdad. Then we transferred to another train, which took us up to an outpost called Shagat, and then from Shagat to Mosul we went by lorry, eventually arriving at Mosul by lorry.
What sort of squadron was Number 6 Squadron?
Well, it was classed as a Number 6 Army Cooperation Squadron, but there was no army in Mosul, no English army, no British army. There was a Punjabi regiment or a Punjabi battalion. The British army was based back in Baghdad, the policy being then that they thought that the Air Force could police the district and call on the army if so needed, because we were then policing the Kurdistan border, which the year previously had been settled or partially settled by a demarcation commission, which had decided whereabouts the boundary would be run. And then we had various communities such as the Assyrians and the Kurds trying to separate them. They had their places in the hills, and we were supposed to keep our eye on them by reconnaissance, daily reconnaissance.
What sort of aircraft were No. 6 Squadron equipped with?
Well, we called them Bristol Fighters. I'm not quite sure whether fighter is a true name, but they were known as Bristol Fighters. They had I think they had one gun firing through the prop forward, and they had a scarf ring with a single Lewis gun on the in the rear cockpit. And one aeroplane out of the two on the reconnaissance carried a wireless operator.
Now, as a wireless operator, you would also be responsible for the rear gun. Had you had any training as a gunner?
Well, we had musketry training at Uxbridge, and we had musketry training, and we fired had firing courses in Iraq, and we were given the rudimentary elements of how to clear a stoppage of a Lewis gun. It was wasn't very complicated, really. It was just a round pan of ammunition which you clamped on the top, and it rotated if you fired it.
While you were with No. 6 Squadron, I believe you were on detached service in the mountains, is that correct?
Yes. After I'd done some months as a flying operator, a wireless operator, where we used to do reconnaissance each morning, looking for ground signals that required our assistance or our we had to notify base that there was trouble in the district. I after a spell back at Mosul, I was sent out to one of the frontier posts, of which there were six. There were six along the frontier, and I was at Babadi, and there was two operators, or operator mechanics. Mechanics were necessary because we were supposed to be self-supporting. We had a small engine for charging our batteries. We had a transmitter, a receiver. We had telescopic masts, which we had to put up, and we had to keep watch on alternative days at these outstations. The particular station I had, was a village called Babadi, and we had a battalion of levies. I would say they were Assyrian levies. They certainly weren't Arabs, they were Assyrian levies. And we had, attached to the wireless station, we had 11 mules, 8 for pack mules and 3 for riding, because we had one of the Syrians as a bearer or as escort, who also did our cooking.
What were your duties at this outstation?
Well, at the outstation, we had to, early morning, we would compile a weather report, very much on the lines of the shipping forecast now, on a code. We would send this weather report first thing in the morning to Mosul, which was our main station, and thereafter, during the day, we would have regular routine calls to Mosul, passing any information or receiving any information, and communicating with the reconnaissance aircraft if and when necessary. Also at these outstations there was an alleged forced landing ground, so that if the aircraft did by chance have to come down, then there was a landing ground available for it to come down.
How long were you on this outstation?
I was at Babadi and at the summer camp, which we moved up to when the weather got warm, for 14 months. We were snowbound at Babadi. It was actually 4 days' walk or mule trek from the nearest foothills. It took us 4 days to get there. And then when the weather got warm, we packed up the camp, loaded it onto the mules, and trekked up the gorge, Armadier Gorge, I think it was, so Armadier Gorge, to a plateau about 6,000 feet up, nearer the Turkish frontier, and we stayed the summer months up there, moving down again when the winter came and back into the original place at the village by Babadi.
Was there any trouble on the frontier when you were there?
Not in my district. There always appeared to be a little bit of skirmishing farther along the frontier where there was a Sheikh of Bar, I think he was called the Sheikh of Barzan, but then he was a troublemaker the year before, and as far as I was concerned in my district where I was, there was no fighting, but I wouldn't say that there wasn't skirmishes up farther up the frontier towards the what is now the Iranian border, which was then Persia.
Number 6 Squadron would be doing a lot of its flying over mountains.
Yes, it was mountainous. In fact, the camp we were actually in was in a valley, and we used to fly up to the end, as you might say, of the valley, and fly along the valley, keeping clear of the sides, just in case the Kurds took a chance of a pot shot at us. But it was mostly mountains, a very turbulent flying, and not at all what you might call a picnic, not as far as flying was concerned. And as far as wireless was concerned, at its infancy, it was a little bit dodgy because of the mountains, and you could easily have got out of communication with your main station at times when you were weaving your way along.
You said that flying conditions were quite difficult. Do you remember any accidents happening, any flying accidents while you were there?
Well, there was always one or two. Somebody would go over on their nose, forced landings. I, at a later stage, when I went to a second outstation for a short spell of duty, I forced landed at a place called Erbil, but there was always somebody that would tip over on their nose or crash land in the desert, or due to the fact that oil pressure trouble or some similar thing like that, because the aircraft were, after all, ex-First World War aircraft, but they weren't new.
After being in Iraq for almost 3 years, you were posted in November 1928 to Egypt, to number 45 Bombing Squadron at Helwan.
Yes, I was 3 years in Iraq, because the third year I went to another outstation nearer the Persian frontier for 6 weeks to relieve some operators. Actually, this man that came out with me had been in a crash, and he was a bit of a liability as a wireless operator, but he'd been in a crash, and he was sent up there mostly as a rescuer, and I was up there operating the wireless set. That was nearer the Persian frontier. That was in 1928. That was in the third year of my stay. In between times, I had been back to Mosul, engaged in either wireless operating on the main station or a station mechanic or some other sundry duties that my trade permitted me to do. But at the end of 28, I did go to Egypt via Karachi to 45 Bomber Squadron at Helwan, which is outside Cairo.
What sort of aircraft were No. 45 Squadron operating when you joined them?
They had DH-9As.
This is another ex-World War I aircraft.
An ex-World War I aircraft, yes. The usual fabric with biplane, and towards the end of its useful life, I would say. But while I was there, we did re-equip. We re-equipped with Fairey 3Fs, which were still a biplane, but an improvement on the old DH-9s.
What was No. 45 Squadron's duties?
It was Bomber Squadron. It was noted to be a bomber squadron, but there again, it was policing. We policed the canal, we policed the frontier along the Med, we went down and laid and checked all the forced landing grounds right from Cairo down to the border of Sudan, which was Aswan. Every so many miles down, every few hundred miles, we used to have dumps and forced landing grounds, and we used to go down there and check that the petrol stocks were available, oil was available, everything was available in case anybody did force land. Because we used to communicate, or we used to probably meet up with 47 Squadron, who were then at Khartoum.
What were your own duties with 45 Squadron?
Well, 45 Squadron, I had various duties because the signals officer there was a warrant officer, and I was the next senior, which I was a corporal. So that I, in addition to being station mechanic, and therefore responsible for the transmitting station, the serviceability of the wireless station, I also had to do a certain amount of flying. I flew with the commanding officer when he wanted me to. I also had to fly to do checks after serviceability checks by the wireless operator, because they had to be checked and double checked after, say, 20 hours or 50 hours or 100 hours flying, the aircraft, this installation had to be checked, and somebody in a responsible position had to countersign and double check them. So that I did get a measure of flying in there down to Luxor and Aswan, as well as the normal routine maintenance of checking and double checking.